This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Bob Garfield is out this week, a week in which we're offering an updated version of a previously broadcast show devoted to the business, the future, the very definition of books. The landscape keeps changing, but whenever we consider books, we encounter fear and loathing and the common complaint that there are just too many of them.
We have reason to fear that the multitude of books which grows every day in a prodigious fashion will make the following centuries fall into a state as barbarous as that of the centuries that followed the fall of the Roman Empire.
Too many books is an old complaint. Historian Adrian Ballett wrote that in 1685. Plummeting book prices is another. In the publishing world, December 3rd, 2008, stands out as the day when the industry's struggles climaxed in some metaphorical bloodletting. They call it Black Wednesday. On that day, Colin Robinson was a relatively recently hired senior editor at Scribner.
That morning, I was called into my boss's office, the corner office, and the two of them were in there, and they said, "Would I close the door?" That's always a bad sign. And they offered me the comfortable chair. And at that point, I thought, oh, this is it.
And similar bloodbaths were occurring at Random House, Houghton Mifflin, HarperCollins.
There were a lot of layoffs that day. Why they all decided to do it on one day, I don't know.
Last year, Colin Robinson started a publishing venture with a friend, John Oakes, called Or Books, named for their initials, and to suggest an alternative way of doing business. Because, they say, people still love books, but in our excruciatingly cluttered media environment, people and books have a much harder time finding each other.
First of all, there is a huge overproduction of titles. Writing books is incredibly easy, much, much easier than it used to be. You can get it edited electronically, you can typeset it yourself, you can easily get short-run printers to distribute it, or you can distribute it electronically. And so I think it's a really great time for writers and not such a good time for readers.
Is it because the tastemakers, the gatekeepers, have been swept away in the electronic tide? There are no more, or very few, freestanding book reviews anymore. Amazon and reader reviews have taken the place of established book reviewers in most people's lives. Is that what you're saying? Because, you know, some might say that's a little elitist.
Well, I don't think it is elitist. I think if you give people a choice between 100 things, that's a real choice. If you give them a choice between 500,000 things, it's no choice at all.
I think that's a self-serving proclamation. What they mean is there's too many of everyone else's books.
Michael Cater is the founder of Publishers Marketplace, which provides information for the book business. He says if they think the market is crowded now, with more than 500,000 new books in the U.S. each year, then just wait.
What looks big now will be mind-bogglingly small soon, right? Because ebooks and print-on-demand and scanning of old books and putting them back into the system have made it possible, with little or no cost, to produce books in bulk. Case in point, the University of Michigan Library is using some of the scans that were developed in conjunction with Google to make available 400,000 books, old books, public domain books that had gone out of print. That's equivalent to almost a current year's output of new titles. So, yes, that number is going to go up in ways that people can barely conceive of.
So that's got to mean the publishing business is going to tank, right?
The absolute numbers about the state of the business are sort of what they always were. Flat is good. Up a little is better. Down a little is kind of the norm, too. And that's sort of where we are. I mean, given that the country itself has gone through one of the biggest recessions we've seen in years, if not for a century. In a way, it's a daily miracle that as many books get sold as still pass through the cash registers, particularly in a time when attention spans are supposed to be shorter, right? The long-form narrative is supposed to be challenged by the internet and radio and TV and all those other things that we have to do with our time. But there's no clear indication that anything dire has happened there. For a reader, it's boom times. There are more options. There's price competition. There's format competition. There's new ways to read. You can get things delivered faster. They're accessible online. There's more voices. There's more communities to serve you. So for readers, it's terrific.
Wow. I'll have what you're having. But I thought people were buying fewer books.
Not really, no. And in fact, I think there's an important contrast to make between books and other media. The market for DVDs has dropped considerably in the last year or two. The circulation of major newspapers and magazines has dropped precipitously. And there is an easy inclination to say, oh, book publishing has layoffs and they have pain. It must be analogous. It isn't analogous. The numerical declines we're seeing in traditional book publishing are far, far smaller.
Really? Because, I mean, we can't really follow those numbers very well. In fact, we can't follow any numbers in the book industry. There seems to be no transparency.
We do have some statistical data. It is not complete, and it doesn't line up easily. There's a service called Nielsen BookScan that tracks book sales at cash registers. So the data they gather is excellent. The insufficiency is they don't gather data from everywhere books are sold, in part because the book market is so complex, right? You can buy it at the airport, you can buy it in a grocery store, all those other discrete venues where books are sold that have not engaged with Nielsen BookScan yet. By their estimate, their figures cover about 70% of the market. So you look at their numbers, you can see for this year, the market is down between 2 and 3% compared to last year, but probably more or less even with the year before.
So then talk about ebook sales. Are they killing the business? Are they the future of the business?
Yes. We don't know. We're only guessing. The best data we have there is reports from individual publishers who know themselves what portion of their revenues are coming from ebooks.
Thus far in 2010, Cater estimates that ebooks make up about 8% of total book sales, buoyed by the iPad.
It doesn't take astrophysicists to tell you, gee, maybe that slice that's missing from the physical book marketplace has actually just moved and is now buying books in electronic form instead of physical form.
For the first time in more than 25 years, American adults are reading more literature, according to a study released in January of 2009 by the National Endowment for the Arts. The biggest increases are among young adults aged 18 to 24. This new growth reverses two decades of downward trends cited in previous reports. It certainly was down 2 years ago when we did our first hour on books, and nearly 15% of all U.S. adults read literature online in 2008, some of them probably on their iPhones.
Well, you should see my story reading, baby. You should hear the things that she says. She says, hun, drop dead, I'd rather go to bed with Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Got a love with William S. Burroughs. Leave on the light for bell hooks. I've been flirting with P.A. Burton because he's so smart in his books. I like to go out dancing. My baby loves a bunch of authors. My heart's a broken bleeding. Baby's just sitting there. Doing some reading.
So how do the publishers find his baby?
You know, there's the old business rule of three, where you see something three times and then it sticks in your head. Well, I think the new business rule is, you know, the rule of nine.
Carrie Goldstein is an associate publisher for 12, which publishes only 12 books a year and backs each to the hilt. They have an impressive track record for creating bestsellers.
We have to place things so variously so that people will remember it, because the news cycle moves so quickly and it's difficult to maintain those things that you were interested in because they're replaced by something else 5 minutes later.
Rule of nine is a tall order.
Yeah, but that's how it is. You know, we have to do much more now to get less.
Colin Robinson, formerly of Scribner, now co-founder of Or Books, is taking 12's path, but going further by selling directly to consumers and not relying on book vendors who demand deep discounts.
So we're not going to do very many books. We're going to do one a month, maybe two some months. But we are going to spend $50,000 to $100,000 promoting each book.
Book selling without bookstores.
Right.
And without Amazon?
And without Amazon, too. And we can't, in the model we're working on, we can't give this discount away because we are using it for promotion.
Robinson is good at this. When he was an editor at Verso Books, he once successfully marketed a smart new edition of the Communist Manifesto as a fashion accessory, almost got it into a Barney's window display. In November of 2009, Orr hit a promotional home run in its first time at bat. Let's talk about your first book, a collection of essays by many liberal-leaning writers called Going Rouge, Sarah Palin, An American Nightmare. It came out on November 16th. I don't know if you know this, but turns out Sarah Palin's biography called Going Rogue, Sarah Palin, An American Life, came out on the 17th. I'm sure that was a wild coincidence.
Well, no, I mean, very annoyingly, HarperCollins have picked the same date for the publication of their book as as we did for ours. And, you know,
they chose their date first.
Well, that's what you say. I suppose this is a kind of jujitsu approach to publishing. I mean, we are trying to use the strength of our opponent against themselves. In that respect, we have been successful beyond our wildest dreams.
Today, effective promotion requires jujitsu, and also usually the author. Neil Gaiman is the author of blockbuster science fiction, graphic novels, children's books, a TV series. He has an interactive blog, Twitter feed, and a fan base that will follow him anywhere. But it won't if he's not there.
Smart authors may wind up having to revert to the world of Charles Dickens, where Dickens was being extensively pirated in America. So what he did to make money across America was he would do reading tours, because he could give them that one thing that they couldn't get from a pirated edition of his books. He could give them Charles Dickens reading, and people would come out for that. So maybe we're heading for a world in 10 or 15 years in which Stephen King may not be making any money from his new book, but he's going to be packing arenas and reading it to them. Be fun.
Book writing, he says, still is and always will be a lonely enterprise. But book selling, well, increasingly, that's going to require some serious FaceTime.
So we split and went to a party. Some friends my girl said she knew. But what a sight, because it's author's night and the place looks like a who's who. Now I'm pounding the Uzo.
With Mario Puzo.
Who's a funny fella?
W.P. Kinsella.
Who brought the cat?
What, Margaret Atwood?
Who needs a shade?
He's Robertson Davies.
Andace started a boat bike. Someone moves all over the scene. Yeah.
Spilled some dressing on Doris Lessing. These writer types are a scream. I like to go out dancing. My puppy villa's a bunch of authors. We'll be together for ages.
Eating and sleeping and.
Eating and sleeping and.
Turning pages.
Fundamentally, the publishing business is teetering on the brink of ruin, hurtling toward the precipice, awash and adrift in a sea of books. In other words, more or less, the same as it ever was. Coming up, the man who loved books too much. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Reading a book, losing oneself in the imagination of an author, is usually a solitary enterprise. So too is writing a book, says author Neil Gaiman.
Writing is like death, a very lonely business. You do it on your own. Somebody is always sitting there figuring things out. Somebody is always going to have to take readers somewhere they have never been before.
But as books move from printed page to networked screen, it grows easier for writers and readers to gather in the virtual margins to discuss the plot and characters, and for readers to actually help shape them. Crowdsourcing artistic expression in this way may seem contrary to the rules of creativity. Books by committee? But Bob Stein, founder of the Institute for the Future of the Book, sees an inevitable merging of writer and reader. As someone who for decades has experimented with new forms for books, he's used to people who grew up with traditional books reflexively rejecting his ideas, as when he explained his vision to a group of biographers.
One of the people in the room was one of these writers who gets a $2 million advance, goes away for 10 years, literally, writes a book, sells a lot of copies, and then does it all over again. So I said to him, instead of getting your $2 million advance and going away for 10 years, how about if your publisher announced to the world, so-and-so is going to start work on a biography of Barack Obama? Who's interested? And N thousands of people say, yes, I'm interested, and they subscribe to your project, and they pay $2 a year, whatever it is. I said, at the end of 10 years, you'll have a body of work, and you'll have the same $2 million. The difference will be that you've done this in public, and you've done this with a group of people helping you in various ways. And he, of course, as I expected, you know, put his fingers up and across saying, oh my God, that's the most horrible thing I've ever heard of. That's the last thing I ever want to do. And I said to him, I'm willing to bet you that there's a young woman who's getting her PhD right now who grew up in MySpace, in Facebook, somebody who is comfortable and excited about working in a public collaborative space. She is a seed of the future.
How do you make money in your vision? The subscription model?
It's all subscription. The day that the author is no longer interested and she doesn't want to work with the readers any longer, she stops getting royalties.
You know, there are many authors who talk about a quiet place, a moment of inspiration, alone.
It's very interesting. The very concept of an author, the very idea that somebody owned an idea, is extremely recent. Remix culture, you know, where something is constructed from lots of different parts. Remix culture was actually the standard until print came along. Print actually changed everything because suddenly you weren't relying on
an oral tradition.
On the oral tradition.
I'm simply raising the fact that whether or not the author holding up his hands in a Get Thee From Me Satan position is a biographer or a philosopher or a novelist, there's not necessarily a role, at least in the beginning of creation, for the reader.
We're definitely in a space where it's almost impossible to argue about this.
Because you're projecting into a future where that quiet place will no longer be necessary?
Basically, yeah.
What about the thingness of books?
I'll miss it. I love holding the object in my hand. On the other hand, when I'm online and suddenly my daughter who lives in London shows up in the margin of something we're reading together, chills go up and down my spine. Being able to share an experience of reading with people whose judgment I care about is deeply rewarding. Here's a wonderful sort of factoid which may be helpful. The Western version of the printing press is invented in 1454. It takes 50 years for page numbers to emerge. It took humans that long to figure out that it might be useful to put numbers onto the pages. We're at the very, very beginning of the shift from the book to whatever is going to become more important than it. I realize that there's a way to see what I'm saying and sort of say, there is a truly mad man. And in a lot of ways, I can't prove it, but you understand the problem.
I do. We can't know what the future is going to be. We have different visions. Actually, I don't have much of a vision at all, and you have a pretty detailed one.
Back in, I think, 1991, I had the first little notebook computer that Apple made, and we had made a little demo of an electronic book on it. I used to get trotted around the world to give talks a lot. As part of these talks, I would lie down on the stage and lean the little power book up against my knee and show how I could, you know, read in bed. Everybody thought I was literally crazy. Nobody would ever read off of a screen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, 18 years later, screen reading is not necessarily as horrible as people thought. And in fact, some people actually like it. When you're at the beginning of a transition like we are, it's tremendously difficult to sort of hold the past, the present, and the future in your head all at one time.
Bob, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Bob Stein is the director of the Institute for the Future of the Book. Kirshner is a dean at the City University of New York and a scholar of Victorian literature. Last year, we spoke with Kirshner about an experiment of sorts, reading the Charles Dickens novel Little Dorrit four ways, as a paperback on her Kindle and her iPhone and as an audiobook. Here's what that sounds like.
Everything in Marseille and about Marseille had stared at the fervid sky and been stared at in return, until a staring habit had become universal there. Strangers were stared out of countenance by staring white houses, staring white walls, staring white streets, staring tracts of arid road, staring hills from which verdure was burnt away.
Kirshner says she started by pulling her old Penguin paperback edition down from her bookshelf.
The first thing that just washed over me was nostalgia, because there was my name and the date and my little marginalia that I had written as a graduate student. So it was like encountering myself as well as encountering Dickens. the paperback felt absolutely wonderful in my hands. But then I left my apartment and went down into the New York City subway. And in a crowded New York City subway, it's a little hard to maneuver that paperback. And so I started thinking, well, maybe I should look at the audiobook, Little Dorrit, as well, because I'm an audiobook lover.
Aha. Uh-huh. You are an audiobook lover, and yet many will dismiss this way of reading as not really reading at all.
Oh, I think that's an ideological falsity. It's reading. It's just reading in a different format. When you read an audiobook, you're sort of at the mercy of the narrator. You can't easily go back. You can't easily go forward. So you're a relatively passive reader, but it lends itself to reading in all kinds of unusual places. You know, you're having your teeth cleaned. Great time to read an audiobook.
Well, let's skip over to the Kindle, which I understood you received as a gift more than a year ago. Did that change the way you took in the story, absorb the words?
Reading electronically, you have a lot more control. If you want to make the font larger, you can. If you want to play with the margins, you can. What I didn't like about the Kindle was that I had to make a conscious decision to take it with me.
Mm-hmm. I have a friend who said she likes it better than a book because turning the virtual page is so instantaneous and effortless that she felt like a rat in a Skinner box pushing for a pellet, another pellet, another pellet, in a good way.
Then she ought to try the iPhone, because one of the areas that I actually find annoying about the Kindle is that little click, 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 because there's a nanosecond when the screen goes black. And I found that that really sort of disturbed my sense of seamless reading.
Ah, the iPhone, which seems on the face of it to offer the least enjoyable experience because the screen is so small. And yet I have a friend who reads Jane Austen on hers. Hi, Lynn. Is she weird?
She's not weird at all. Go, Lynn. The iPhone was the revelation to me. The screen is brighter, crisper. You can change pages instantaneously. But the most important thing is that the iPhone is always with you, or at least always with me. And, you know, the old Woody Allen line, 70% of success in life is just showing up. The iPhone showed up.
That was Ann Kirshner in June of 2009. It's a year later, and Kirshner tells us that she now has yet a fifth way to read Little Dorrit. The ultimate seduction for you now is the iPad.
Yes.
Why?
Yes. Well, it's a Swiss Army knife. So it becomes my calendar. It becomes my note taker. It becomes something I can play with if I have, you know, half an hour to play Scrabble or something like that. Then the ultimate great use of time, reading, beckons because it's simply the best e-reader in town.
We should also add you can also connect to the internet with it.
How could we have left that out? Right. You can sail forth onto the internet. You can seamlessly make a transition from reading to whatever else it is you need to do. So it's the ubiquity factor. It's always with you because it is so multi-purpose.
What you used to say about the iPhone.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I fooled myself that the size of the iPhone screen wasn't an issue. And, you know, and I think it was the best that it could be at that moment. And you know what? A year from now, we're going to say the same thing about the iPad.
Well, you wrote a piece recently in the Chronicle of Higher Education titled My iPad Day. And in the comments below the piece, someone wrote, quote, I found this article nauseating in its fetishism.
I couldn't imagine what that person meant.
You couldn't?
Well, you know, you could say the same thing about a book. I have a friend recently who produced a memoir to which he added beautiful illustrations, tipped in pictures. It was beautifully bound. There is something, I guess, fetishistic about a beautiful volume, but I have no problem translating that into a digital dimension and saying that iPads are quite beautiful as well.
Anne, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anne Kirshner is Dean of Macaulay Honors College at the City University of New York and author of Sala's Gift. The thingness of books is a sensual experience of sight, smell, feel. How much more intense when a book is old, that carries its years, its proximity to its writer within its faded bindings. That's why people obsess over old books and why they steal them. Book theft is rampant. Most steal to sell, But one of the nation's greatest book thieves just wanted a rich man's library, and he has spent his life armed with stolen credit card numbers and punctuated by stretches in the slammer, stealing what he coveted. In her book, The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, Alison Hoover Bartlett profiles John Gilkey, a man for whom books were building blocks for a whole new identity.
As a child, he watched the Sherlock Holmes movies, and he fell in love with this idea that you could be a gentleman with a grand library and that people would be impressed by this. And so his goal was to convey to the world just how cultured and erudite he wanted to be.
And yet his books didn't follow any particular pattern.
No, he did steal books that he had read that he liked. Sometimes they were mysteries or detective novels or 19th century novels. And then he shifted to following a list from the Modern Library. It was a list of the best 100 novels in the English language. A lot of collectors follow lists. Where he's really different is that he stepped over to the dark side as the bibliodick, or book detective in my book, described him.
The bibliodick you mentioned, arguably the Sherlock Holmes of book thievery, is a Salt Lake City bookstore owner named Ken Sanders.
Well, he has a rare bookstore in Salt Lake City, but he was also working as the security chair for the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, the ABAA. In his mind, there's almost nothing more wrong than stealing books. And what would happen is when one of his colleagues would have a book stolen, they would immediately notify Sanders, and Sanders would then alert the rest of the trade.
How did he catch him?
He caught him, Gilkey, that is, by communicating with everybody to be on the lookout for certain conversations that he would have, the manner that he spoke, what he would ask for. So that at one point, when one of his colleagues believed that he might have Gilkey on the line, of course, Gilkey never used his own name. He would use the name of a credit card holder. That dealer knew to contact Sanders, and then a sting was put into place with the help of law enforcement.
If Ken Sanders, his adversary, thinks stealing books is the worst thing in the world, Gilkey feels the opposite, that if he can't afford it, he deserves to take it.
He told me that when he walks into a rare bookshop and sees all these treasures there, that he almost views it as the personal property of the bookstore owner and thinks, how unfair. This person has so many books. I just want a few of them. The insurance company will pay them back. And so people are going to steal. And if you're going to have a business, you have to expect it. And those things are going to happen.
Like the weather.
Exactly. It was strange. And sometimes he would describe a theft and say, because he'd have somebody else go pick up the book, well, I didn't steal from them. Somebody else picked up the book.
Tell me about Gilkey's life.
He lives in San Francisco. It's a far cry from the sort of house with a grand library that he dreams of. For a while he was on parole in San Francisco, and he still is, by the way, I think through this year, he was living in a little flea bag motel. And he's never held a job for very long. He has a degree in economics. He spends a lot of his days going to the library, doing research about books. He's always got a big file with him with notes of books that he's thinking of getting, as he said. He would never say steal. And writings that he's doing. He wrote an homage to one of the authors whose books he's stolen, John Kendrick Bangs. He wrote a play based on that man's work. So he's writing and reading a lot, and that was one of the qualities that I admired in him. Here he was, clever and hardworking and ambitious and curious, and I always thought if he could only apply these attributes to something worthwhile or at least legal.
You remember having an odd reaction when describing Gilkey's life of periodic arrests to a friend, and she responded, "How sad."
Yeah, I realized that it wasn't actually all that sad, that he was making progress with this goal. He was slowly amassing a large library. He was interrupted frequently by these stints in prison. But, you know, he got a great deal of satisfaction from the pursuit of the collection. And while it may look sad and certainly angers a lot of people the way that he's living, I think he has achieved some measure of success along the way.
This is a man who, in the pursuit of his criminal occupation, has enrolled in college courses to study existentialism, who's studied Iris Murdoch, who's become an expert in his field. Some of the best parts of who he is, one could argue, come from the worst parts.
Yeah. You know, the first time I met him was in prison. He was dressed in his orange prison garb and seated behind a plexiglass window. We were in one of those booths. And yet there he was discussing the 19th century novels that he had stolen. And I thought this juxtaposition of the bookish and the criminal was just fascinating.
Allison, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Allison Hoover Bartlett is author of The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, in bookstores now. Coming up, novels about war that blend fact and fiction, and books about pimps and dope fiends that do the same. This is On the Media from NPR.
On the Media is supported by Ann and John Herman, supporting the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at breakthroughcollaborative.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with an updated version of our previously broadcast book show. NPR political analyst Juan Williams wrote in the Wall Street Journal last year that books by Black people for Black people are too often about, quote, young, poor minorities who think that short-term pleasure and violence are glamorous and the way to the top. Williams was talking about a genre called urban fiction, which, though it began in the 1960s, is enjoying a kind of renaissance in recent years. And with its renewed popularity comes renewed criticism. On the Media producer Mike Volo has the story.
Iceberg Slim was a pimp. In 1969, he published a fictionalized account of his very real life and pioneered a new genre of American literature. He called his book simply Pimp.
You gotta make 'em hard and fast to stick 'em for long, scratch quick. Pimpin' ain't no game of love. So pride 'em and keep your swipe out of 'em. Any sucker who believes a whore loves him shouldn't have fell out of his mammy's ass.
40 years ago, a violent and vulgar book about whoring in the Black ghetto would have a tough time getting reviewed in the mainstream press. So the publisher, Holloway House, marketed Pimp in the inner city, building a kind of distribution network of liquor stores and barbershops. It carved out a niche, specializing in books about what it called the Black experience, which Holloway defined as gritty urban tales.
I felt powerful and beautiful. I thought I was still Black in the white man's world. But it was simple. Just pimp my ass off and get a ton of scratch. Everybody in both worlds kissed your ass, Black and blue, if you had flash in front.
Donald Goines was a junkie. He read Pimp while serving time in a penitentiary and soon after fictionalized his own life in the novel Dope Fiend, an appalling story of the crime and degradation that comes with chasing a heroin addiction.
She began to run her finger up and down until she could feel the vein she was searching for. Without hesitation, she plunged the dull needle down into her groin.
In a fit of writing over several years, before he was shot to death in Detroit, Goines wrote more than a dozen novels for Holloway House, which became a small empire of Black publishing through the 70s and 80s, though few outside of a core Black readership even noticed.
I loved growing up in the projects with me and, like, all of my cousins, like 15 of us in the house.
Quan is a contemporary author of urban fiction who was influenced by Slim and Goines. He grew up in the Frederick Douglass houses in New York City.
Our lives were just as rich as the kids that we went to school with that didn't live in the projects. And then crack came, and everybody went crazy. You know, people that you recall seeing at your house, they, like, smoked out or doped out. So you look at that person like, well, I remember you used to work for the post office. You had a good job. We all looked up to you because you was, like, one of the few people in the projects working. It was just crazy to see everybody get caught up by it, even my parents.
Like many authors of urban fiction, Quan used his own life to find a way to a different one.
I was about to have a baby. I didn't have a job, you know, so I was getting my little hustle on. I was robbing people and selling drugs. So people told me I was crazy when I said, you know what, I'm going to be a writer. They laughed at me and they said, you're a criminal. What could you possibly have to write about that people would want to listen to? Well, you know.
Kwan lifted the copy of his first book, Gangsta, from my dining room table and held it up in the air. He says he intended the book as a kind of memoir in the tradition of Iceberg Slim. And like with Slim, it's not clear where reality ends and fiction begins. The protagonist of Gangsta is Lulok, a gang member who controls a lot of the drug trade in Harlem.
I want at least one blood on every set drop. I want it to be made crystal clear that we want the nigga or the bitch that gave the order. If they don't up them, we keep killing, period.
Since 2002, Kwan has written nearly a dozen novels, brutally violent and sexually graphic, all starring characters who want desperately to leave the criminal life, though they usually die trying. It's a continual theme throughout all of urban fiction, which in the past decade has exploded in popularity with hundreds of new titles.
Now, these things are distributed everywhere from street corner tables in Harlem to Barnes & Noble.
Justin Gifford is a professor of English at the University of Nevada.
They are the center of the literary conversation about African-American literature right now. They make up a full half of the titles being published by black authors. So what started off as this relatively unknown subculture is now the driving force of the African-American publishing industry.
Nick Childs is a newspaper reporter turned novelist.
If you drop down from another planet into a Borders and you went to the African-American literature section, you would think that the African-American community was crass, superficial, didn't really think very deeply about very many issues aside from sex and violence.
A few years ago, Childs wrote an op-ed for the New York Times in which he charged urban fiction authors with glamorizing and glorifying black criminals.
And I have a hard time with that. The community has decided that it's okay for this to be our art. The art that we consume and that we produce is about how destructive we are to each other.
The books are graphic, the books are violent, but so are the neighborhoods that we live in.
Urban fiction author Kwan.
If you think that this stuff is offensive, can you imagine or do you have an idea what it feels like for this to actually be your life?
Childs says the content wouldn't be so troubling if not for the genre's predominance, pushing other black voices off the shelves. But the major publishers see urban fiction more as a trend. Monique Patterson is Kwan's editor at St. Martin's Press. She says, yeah, sure, there's a lot of it, but...
Before urban fiction, it was a lot of relationship novels. A lot. Everywhere. All the time. Everything is cyclical in publishing.
But it's been a decade now going pretty strong, so it may be cyclical, but this cycle seems to be taking a long time.
Childs worries, too, about urban fiction's preoccupation with authenticity, the idea that an author has to have lived the life, like Iceberg Slim, like Donald Goines, like Kwan, in order to write about it.
You know, I don't have to have been a criminal to write an entertaining story about life on the streets, but somehow we've gotten to the point where that's a selling point. People want to know, did this happen to you? And if it didn't, then your book and your storyline are much less valuable to me.
I wouldn't call it a hard and fast rule.
St. Martin's Press editor Monique Patterson.
It's interesting because I've thought about, like, if you had somebody who didn't live the life at all and wrote a really, really good urban fiction novel, I'm not sure if people would reject it or not.
What would you do as an editor? Would you want to take that book on?
That is a good question. I probably wouldn't. It would have to be that rare, rare case where the book is just so stunning, despite the fact that this person hasn't lived not one bit of this kind of life.
And so what is that saying to a teenage kid who's a talented writer? Does he need to go out and commit crimes?
It's impossible, of course, to say if urban fiction simply reflects the reality of the street or helps create it. And so the whole controversy around urban fiction comes down to the question, why do we read? Escapism? Identification? Prescriptions for how to live or maybe how not to live? We know that lives can be changed by books. What we don't know, can't predict, is how.
Yeah, real.
For On the Media, I'm Mike Vuolla.
I seen the error in your ways. I can never correct the way you wrote your life and how you word your actions. You never looked them over twice. You just jot them down and wouldn't give them any thought. Over paper, you cross a line that wasn't pretty smart. Your whole attitude was way past the margin trying to pass.
Vasily Grossman covered the Eastern Front of World War II for the Soviet Union and fictionalized his reporting as the novel Life and Fate. Curzio Malaparte covered the Eastern Front for the Axis powers and fictionalized his reporting as the novel Kaput. These two, you might say, opposite accounts of the same part of the same war, both a mix of journalism and imagination, were the subject of a New York University panel discussion late last year. I asked veteran war correspondent Chris Hedges, who was on the panel, why Vasily Grossman chose to fictionalize a war that he'd witnessed with his own eyes.
Because, like Tolstoy, he was trying to create an epic and to step beyond what could be empirically measured and talk about those powerful non-rational forces, fear, rage, love, in the midst of this huge backdrop, which was World War II. And to examine human nature, I think, is very difficult when one is constrained by what you see and what you hear, by fact.
One chapter that you think is illustrative of what Grossman was trying to do begins with German prisoners carrying Russian corpses up from the cellar of a building.
She felt in the pocket of her jacket for a piece of bread that had been given to her the evening before by a soldier. She held it out to the German officer and said, "There, have something to eat." Afterwards, she was unable to understand what had happened to her, why she had done this.
There were moments, even in the war itself, when these barriers between two groups broke down. And Grossman meditates on this at the end of the book, that it's not so much a battle of good and evil, but the battle between a great evil that is seeking to crush a small kernel of human kindness. The pathos, even in the enemy that is demonized, makes, I think, the novel particularly rich and something that he certainly could not do as a Soviet correspondent.
There's a letter in the book written by a mother in the ghetto, aware that trenches are being dug nearby for the mass execution of the inhabitants of the ghetto, and she's writing a final goodbye to her son. Now, Grossman's mother was killed by the Nazis. She never got a chance to say goodbye. Is he merely enacting this as a way to mitigate his own grief?
This chapter, the last letter, I think gets to the importance of empathetic imagination, that ability which he had to step inside his mother's head, to see the world from her eyes, to say goodbye to her only son. And as you correctly point out, there was no communication on the eve of his mother's death. She was herded into a ghetto and executed with the other Jews in her town. And yet he is able to present her letter goodbye.
Can you guess what I felt, Vidyenka, once I was behind the barbed wire? I'd expected to feel horror. But just imagine, I actually felt relieved to be inside this cattle pen. Don't think it's because I'm a born slave. No. No, it's because everyone around me shares my fate. Now, people I know look me straight in the eye instead of trying to avoid me.
It is in many ways a letter not just from his mother to him, but from millions of mothers who were murdered to their children.
Grossman talks about obedience, the obedience of the victims and of the perpetrators of the violence. He says that they're both derived from the instinct for self-preservation. I know you really like this passage. Why do you think it's so critical?
Because having been a war correspondent and lived in climates of extreme violence and fear, to stand up against those forces is almost a willful act of suicide. I was at one point a prisoner in Iraq, captured in the First Gulf War by the Republican Guard. Every move that you make, every word that you utter is calculated to ensure your own survival and not to enrage those who have the power of life and death in front of you. This is a human reality that Grossman understood and that is often not grasped by people who have not been in similar situations.
Let's contrast the way that Grossman blended fact and fiction with what Curzio Malaparte did in his novel Caput, which many people regard as a masterpiece, and you think not so much. How was he blending fact and fiction that was different from the way Grossman did?
Malaparte veers in that long tradition of war pornography. It's voyeurism. He doesn't have the moral voice that Grossman has. He seeks the extreme, the outrageous. I mean, just to pick one small scene, there's a moment when he is in the office of the Croatian dictator.
Ante Pavlich removed the lid from the basket and revealed the mussels, that slimy and jelly-like mass, and he said, smiling, "It is a present from my loyal Ustashis, 40 pounds of human eyes."
I deeply detest the Malapartes of the world because they write about war through the lens of the powerful, not through the eyes of the soldiers on the front line who suffer, bleed, and die. Unlike Grossman, he never sees combat. He spends long passages at lavish dinners with the Nazi governor of Poland, writing witty dialogues in which, of course, he always gets the better of whoever it is he is speaking with. It is a bizarre kind of recounting of war as a spectator sport.
There is a passage in Kaput where he describes, quote, "The ghastly cold of that winter had the strangest consequences. Thousands and thousands of soldiers had lost their limbs. Thousands and thousands had their ears, their noses, their fingers, and their sexual organs ripped off by frost. Many had lost their eyelids. Singed by the cold, the eyelid drops off like a piece of dead skin."
You pick a passage that's tough because, on the one hand, he talks about the inevitable maiming, physical maiming of war, which is important for outsiders to understand. On the other hand, he builds repeatedly on these sort of macabre, emotionally mined scenes so that the cumulative effect is a kind of grotesque freak show. And I'm not opposed to the description per se. The problem is that Malaparte never gets beyond it, to the human passions and darkness that go into unleashing violence at that level.
Chris, do you think that war is some kind of special case? It seems like time and time again, from the Greeks to the present day, we try to make sense of war ultimately by fictionalizing it.
I think to struggle with the most powerful forces in human life, fiction is a better medium. I think that somehow it's the mystery itself, the awe that comes when one contemplates existence, that great, great writers like Grossman can, within the sweep of a great narrative, portray for us that elude even very talented nonfiction writers.
Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chris Hedges is a veteran war correspondent and author of, among other books, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Much of the fear and loathing in the book biz can be summed up in two words: unsold books. Unsold books that are sent back from bookstores to their publishers, trucked off to warehouses, and eventually pulped. In 1902, the New York Times ran a piece called Books That Die: The Tragic Fate of Unsold Books. The writer, George Owen Koch, began by observing that a new book was full of possibility. Who knew how far it would go? Quote, "Some volumes turn to the right and follow that branch of the path which leads them to readers, with whom they remain for a while. Others halt and then turn to the left. Their way is short. In the undertaker's shop of the stock dealer, the books that have died in the nursery for lack of attention meet brothers who have seen the world and have been worn out in the service of mankind. But to the funeral director, they are all the same. Put into bales weighing from 500 to 1,500 pounds each, the books are sent on the last stage of their journey to the cemeteries of the mills, where during interment in great tubs, they undergo a cleansing and altering process truly purgatorial, to emerge free from stains of inky sins, but books no longer. As man begins movement toward the grave at the moment of his conception, so a book starts on its way to the boiling vats of the mill at the moment of its inspiration. Some volumes, like some men, reach a great age, yet final disintegration is inevitable. There are uncommon instances of the petrification of human bodies after life is extinct. There are instances of the petrification of old volumes after a period of usefulness. But these, too, shall pass away, for books and men are embalmed permanently only in memory. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Bolo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, with help from Alex Goldman, Brett Jaspers, and Michael Chaplin, and edited by me. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson. Special thanks to all of our readers and to WNYC program director Chris Bannon. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC, I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.